Internet Informed, Guidance for the Dedicated Searcher, as read by the author David Novak. This book is an element of the Spire Project. Chapter 3, Quality. Albert accompanied Friar Carlo, an aging Catholic missionary, on a journey into the Pyrenees Mountains. Church officials wished to dissuade the local pastors from teaching doctrine contrary to the prescribed texts. Certain rural priests had begun preaching concepts of humanism and communalism. To Friar Carlo, such ideas were abhorrent heresy, an ultimate sin imperiling the very souls of these country peasants. Albert believed differently. He knew the locals as peaceful frontier folk. He genuinely liked them and easily tolerated their occasional oddities. The white-haired missionary from Rome sought to convert these heathens back to a life with Jesus, which was a little amusing since the locals already considered themselves Christians. Only foreigners like Friar Carlo considered them heathens or Cathars. Of course, the priest needed no protection. No one would do violence against the traveling missionary. Albert's presence only served to ease political tension back in Toulouse. On this trip, Albert felt certain the peasants would listen, a few would convert again to Catholic doctrine, and local practices would continue as they had for several centuries, building, slowly building, into a distinct southern French culture. However, this friar's preaching included a serious threat. Vatican leaders were becoming frustrated. A persistent alienation threatened the foundation of Catholic unity. Like a slow poison working its evil magic first in the limbs, a cure was most urgently required. If this trend towards religious diversity was not reversed, it would imperil everything the Catholic Church had worked to achieve. As Albert trudged along the rocky path leading into the Pyrenees, he pondered an unspoken question. How would the Church draw the line between Catholicism and heresy? The information revolution washes over us. It picks us up and pushes us forward like so much driftwood. From now on, our lives will be forever awash with information. We eat it, breathe it, live in it, drown in it. Some of us will even learn to live for it. Yet we do not crave the consumption of more information. Overeating just makes us fat. We crave instead answers to questions, even to questions we can't quite articulate. As we hunt for that perfect item of information that will satisfy all our concerns and solve our challenges, remember, such information may well exist. It often exists. Yet it stands alongside much comparable but less satisfying information. Perfect information hides in plain sight. We deserve information we can trust. We deserve quality. We deserve definitive and comprehensive answers too, but we're half a book too early to tackle that challenge. Let us first deal with this issue of quality, for astonishingly, we can deal with this concern completely. Once we know how, quality is obvious. The internet is the most quality transparent medium we have. I find an insightful article to accompany my steaming cup of hibiscus flower tea as I sit reading in a tea house I do not often visit. The article is lively, well written. It describes with clarity the peculiar nuances to the bloody conflict between India and Pakistan over mountainous Kashmir. It makes several intriguing suggestions. I put down the well-thumbed magazine, sip my hot tea, and ponder an unspoken question. How much truth resides in this article? Quality is always an issue. I'm not so naive as to believe everything is true all the time. People lie, people persuade. Even when facts are rendered accurately and faithfully, facts can be selectively presented. Choose a few undisputed facts that favor a chosen position, marshal them into a logical argument, now set aside the facts that would refute or weaken this position, voila, a persuasive argument that leads in a natural progression all the way to our chosen conclusion. Such arguing, such persuasion, will probably lead others to agree to something they would not agree to if they knew all the facts. Because of this, all of us have a serious difficulty. We simply cannot judge information solely by its reasonableness. Sound arguments are reassuring, most certainly, but a declaration of truth, quality, and trust must stand on more than the facts as they are presented. As a topic, quality has depth and spirit. Who wrote the article on Kashmiri politics? Unfortunately, I do not recognize the author's name. The author is not Dominic Dunn, who writes for the magazine Vanity Fair, and whose slant and degree of honesty I think I have tied down. The author is not another of perhaps 50 authors I recognize by name. No, this author comes from just another writer I have never encountered before. The magazine is also new to me. I subscribe to few magazines, but know many by reputation and enjoy several with zeal. I trust The Atlantic for a reputable, detailed read. I know Foreign Policy as a respectable, incisive policy journal. I consider Time as a superficial, biased, yet timely magazine. I do not know the magazine in my hand. Two strikes. I know neither the author nor publisher. The information reaches me from an anonymous source, as it were. I am none the wiser as to the quality of this intriguing article. there is more to consider. For instance, good articles keep good company. I take another sip of my tea, then reach again for the magazine. Glancing first at the table of contents, I rapidly page through the magazine, looking for evidence of quality in the articles that appear nearby. I see name brand advertising. I see an article on the future of NATO. I continue browsing. If I see one word about reading tea leaves or a fundamentalist slogan, my suspicion of value will shatter. Good information keeps good company. This is not just a reflection of the work of a publisher. It reflects any selection process. Good magazines keep good company, too. I found this magazine on the corner table of a tea house, so most likely it is a good mainstream magazine. Tea house owners select magazines that interest their patrons. When I find a magazine in a library, it may be less mainstream, but it will be respectable or at least popular. Librarians purchase the important and prominent magazines for their patrons. When a friend passes me a magazine to read, my friend selects that magazine for my attention. In a sense, the tea house owner, acquisition librarian, and friend all vouch for these magazines. I don't mean they put their reputation on the line, that they believe deeply in the value of these magazines. No, they probably never read the article in question. This influence is more subtle. They vouch for the importance of these magazines, or at least their popularity. They select these magazines instead of others. I, in turn, trust them not to lead me to the trashiest of magazines. Such vouching can be vital. In the field of international politics, some reputable-sounding policy journals are little more than marketing pieces for special interest groups. They become vehicles to broadcast a perspective, and some perspectives in our world are seriously unbalanced. However, such magazines are unlikely to find their way to the side table of a tea house, onto the shelves of a public library, and into our hands courtesy of a friend. Drawing our attention back to the article on Kashmiri politics, we learned very little just now. An interesting article by an unknown author writing in a mainstream publication that appears to publish good articles. That about sums up our assessment. Our avenues explored, I file in my mind the premise of this intriguing article. I attach a questioned uncertainty to its quality. Perhaps when I read of Kashmir again, I will drag this article from the depths of my mind to compare and decide again if the article's solution had merit. A half cup of tea, an intriguing article, and a little detective work makes for a delightfully civilized moment. As I consume my morning policy prediction, I weigh, measure, and judge information. I undertake what is called a quality assessment that, for the most part, I leave unfinished. Can we investigate further? Of course we can. I forgot to look at the author's credentials in the byline. Sometimes the first few pages of a magazine will introduce contributors with a paragraph-long biography. What was the date on the magazine? An old issue would not be so valuable. When was the article first written? Too much may have happened since it was prepared. Can we confirm this magazine is popular? Magazines usually include the circulation number in the January issue. If I see this magazine selling in a Borders bookstore, that too would indicate a fair circulation. Lastly, I forgot to nudge the tea drinker beside me and ask, do you know and trust this magazine? Perhaps this stranger is an acclaimed scholar of Kashmiri politics. Quality assessment saves us from believing in unsupported, unworthy conclusions. This can be very important when decisions must be made. Quality assessment also saves us time. We discard doubtful information when better information is thought nearby. We spend more time with information we trust most. Yet quality assessment works best when quick. This must not be a trial by minutiae or a strenuous test of our patience. We must somehow consider and swiftly decide if information is valuable to us. The inspiration I want you to see is that each of the steps and concerns we shared with our Kashmiri article apply equally on the internet. Permit me to describe a simple framework I call Q4 quality assessment. It is fast, straightforward, and deliciously revealing. I have only gradually pieced it together over the last 3 years, but if you let it, it will dramatically change the way you look at internet information from now on. Q4 quality assessment has 4 dimensions. Q1, internal clues. Q2, author and publisher identity. Q3, context. Q4, endorsements. For each dimension, look in a specific direction, ask a specific question, then make a judgment. When assessing internal clues, observe the spelling, grammar, date, and internal logic of the information. Is the information delivered in a sane, professional manner? When assessing the identity of the author and publisher, consider the credentials, occupation, and source of funding. Does this author and publisher have the experience to deliver this information? If so, where would their bias lie? Context and endorsements direct our attention elsewhere. When we finish, much of the purpose, bias, and value of an item of information will become apparent. The whole process may take as little as 2 minutes. Let us start with internal clues, the most understood aspect of quality. Q1, internal clues to quality. Good information shouts clarity, sanity, and professionalism. We see evidence of this within the spelling, grammar, and writing style. We see further evidence in the presence of a copyright notice, well-crafted images, a link to biographical information, a date, and more. These are all internal clues, meaning simply they're found within the information under consideration. Just read and judge how sane and professional the information seems to be. Evidence of professionalism suggests the manner the author will deal with information when it counts. Make correct use of spelling and grammar, and we presume the author makes correct use of facts as well. Marshal and express an argument succinctly, and we presume the author considers and researches their arguments. Unfortunately, this link between professionalism and value is fairly tenuous. Essentially, we trust that when an author or publisher remembers to check their spelling, then they probably won't misquote Shakespeare. When the author protects a document with a copyright notice, perhaps the document is worth protecting. The internal logic to an author's argument seems to make sense when we understand it, so perhaps the internal logic holds true when we don't. There is a professional approach to working with information. The hallmark is an attention to detail and placing the reader's interests above those of the author. Address our reading concern about bias, currency, and supportive detail. Take steps to help readers appreciate factual nuances and confirm details. Include references. Provide sufficient information to verify pivotal facts. Links to biographical details. These steps and steps like these help us as readers to move beyond persuasion. These steps help us believe and trust a conclusion. This professional approach is very distinct from the inexperienced work of high school students and the empty writing of marketing staff. It is a style built on revealing relevant facts instead of authors pushing their conclusions. When the author and publisher work on our behalf, we more easily trust their content and conclusion. We trust, for instance, that we can verify important details with external sources. We probably will never take the time to verify anything, but the professional approach suggests this trust is not misplaced. In general, we stake an author's reputation on the truthfulness of their arguments. Except that we should verify details. As this picture unfolds, we are implicitly told that should an author try to deceive us, we are helpless to see through this deceit unless committed by a preschooler. We can only hope the culprit slips up, as it were, and some culturally inexperienced political pundit spells a word incorrectly. Perhaps a publisher, intent on convincing us to agree with some key point they passionately believe, absentmindedly declares their affiliation to the Ku Klux Klan. For our part, we stay alert for such mistakes and wonder if the author presents facts or opinions. This is not a very satisfying state of affairs. The eminent Japanese scientist may have excellent reasons for his atrocious spelling. Similarly, an author forgets to include a copyright notice or considers a link to a useful book as clutter instead of scholarship. Perhaps we should consider nothing more of such unforgivable gaffes. Yet this is what we do. Tear a manuscript apart as we look for blunders. Tally them up, then make a judgment. Professional handling of information includes supporting conclusions. Shortly, I will introduce to you an article that tells of international aid agencies kidnapping Muslim children for sale in Western countries, an accusation courtesy of an Islamic fundamentalist much in the news this last decade. Does the author support this accusation effectively? Such a loaded statement surely requires supporting evidence. Not supporting such a loaded statement allows us to label the work as unprofessional and less than sane. Quality information shouts sanity and professionalism. Part of this equation is that serious authors understand that persuasion is delightful, but not in the interest of the reader. To work to the interests of the reader, authors must disclose the uncomfortable facts, the alternative interpretations, the opposing views. They must share something of themselves, especially their credentials. Readers have the right to know. Providing biographical information is simplicity itself on the internet. Just link each article to a separate biography. Away from the internet, authors still must mention credentials and experience, though usually all too briefly. The sane and professional author also reveals any serious bias they may have. An author holds a political office? Let the reader know. An author has a relationship with an organization significant to the issue? Let the reader know. Having bias should certainly not stop anyone from publishing, but bias should be admitted early. A wise reader can easily counter bias by reading information biased an alternative way. This is not too much to ask. When authors do not share their bias in biography, we can label one of two accusations. Firstly, they fail to consider it important. I call this neglect. Perhaps it is truly unimportant. Perhaps including such information is unimportant to the author. The intended audience of peers already knows the author personally, or knows the supporting evidence to the conclusion. The author does not care if their message is conveyed poorly to a distant, unfamiliar audience. We simply are not their audience. Newsgroup and specialist discussions often fall into this category. It was created for a specific group in mind, a group informed by a continuing discussion extending over many messages. Each post is not structured to stand alone or present a conclusion to outsiders effectively. The alternative to neglect is deceit, or more softly, untrustworthiness. The author intentionally decides not to include biographical details and not to mention their bias. Disclosing such details would probably hurt the persuasive power of their information in some way. Many a business or industry will spin off an association or institute to support their primary aims. While these associations and institutes are nominally independent, their perspectives and bias remain firmly with those of their founding and supporting organizations. But do authors and publishers reveal these affiliations? When they do not, or when they disguise a relationship, from our perspectives as readers, the author and publisher place their interests at persuading us above our interest in gathering clear information. However common and normal this behavior may seem, unrevealed relationships damage trust. Yes, trust. As authors, we can lose our readers' trust by being clumsy or by unsuccessfully distancing ourselves from our bias. How can we earn trust? Firstly, mention or reference the work of others who support our conclusions. Quoting the New York Times or the Louvre helps. References show that other credible authors and publishers support some fact or position, too. The NASA technology label on face cream, La Mer, an energy drink, Tang, and many a water purifier tells us the technology conforms to NASA quality standards. Oh, such a relief. If it works on the moon, it'll probably work in my humble kitchen. Secondly, reference the work of people who disagree with our position. In scholarly papers, referring to alternative arguments assures us the author is aware of such arguments, even if considered then rejected. Such references also show the author tries to present the whole picture, tries for a balanced perspective. Thirdly, provide the information necessary to confirm stated facts. Instead of indicating a survey of 9 out of 10 dentists like toothpaste, give us the name of the organization that undertook the survey. Instead of saying scientists discovered a new planet circling a distant star, tell us who discovered it and who verified its existence. Go one step further and link to the confirming statement by a space agency. With internet material, single-click verification to pivotal facts is a great advantage to the reader, and so very simple for the author to include. Fourthly, provide details of the research behind a conclusion. Provide as much as possible so interested readers can confirm for themselves how we reached a conclusion. Consider the technical research report. It includes specific research methodologies. Any reader unsatisfied with a conclusion can read over the method and consider the evidence directly. An author summarizes the results of a survey. Where are the survey questions? Perhaps question 4 was phrased in a misleading manner. Fifthly, consider the concept of margin of error as used in statistical analysis. When the Australian Bureau of Statistics compiles and publishes census and survey results, they also calculate how mathematically certain their results are. With small sample sizes, the margin of error grows. Sharing this uncertainty with the reader shows professionalism. Away from statistics, a careful author may simply draw attention to a drought of relevant studies on a topic. The author may describe a discovery as provisional, awaiting confirmation. Trust is more complicated than this. Indeed, trust, like quality, ultimately depends on other factors like context and what others say of a document. We're not done discussing trust. Surveys deserve our most careful attention. Abbreviated statistics are particularly prone to abuse. John Mueller, in a 2005 article in Foreign Affairs, demonstrated this beautifully with the following. Quote, "It is close to impossible to judge how many people want to get out or stay the course in Iraq at any given time because so much depends on how the question is worded. For example, there is far more support for gradual withdrawal or beginning to withdraw than for withdrawing or immediate withdrawal." John goes on to recount how in August 2005, the Washington Post found a 54%-44% split when questioned, "Do you think the United States should keep its military forces in Iraq until civil order is restored there, even if that means continued U.S. military casualties? Or do you think the United States should withdraw its military forces from Iraq in order to avoid further U.S. military casualties, even if that means civil order is not restored there?" In the same month, a Harris poll reported 36-61% split when questioned, "Do you favor keeping a large number of U.S. troops in Iraq until there is a stable government there, or bringing most of our troops home in the next year?" a 54%-44% split, or 36%-61% split, based on little more than how we phrase our question? How important, then, to hand over the question and not just summarize a survey as a majority supports or barely a third favor? John Mueller's example reminds us that reasonableness does not always equate well with quality. We could easily make a very reasonable argument with either of those two surveys just mentioned. Our very reasonable and persuasive argument, delivered in isolation, seems honest and true, backed by survey integrity even. That each seemingly honest and reasonable argument concludes differently merely proves we must not judge quality by reasonableness alone. Support. Presenting unsupported information is a serious misdemeanor. Without a source, date, margin of error, and a way to confirm for ourselves the truthfulness of information, an author essentially says, "Trust me." And however much we may wish to trust the author, however much we may be led to expect this kind of behavior, an author displays bad manners in asking for this trust. Here was a perfect opportunity to earn the reader's trust, and the author messed up. This is like a journalist quoting unnamed sources, or a news personality saying, "Rumor has it." Why state something without mentioning where it comes from? As readers, we must either trust the author's word, or toss our hands in the air and shout, "What?" to an author who cannot reply. It reminds me of a criticism I long held with a certain set of business benchmarks. These benchmarks provided remarkable detail on how comparable businesses budget their resources. Unfortunately, for all their uniqueness, they even provided a quintile breakdown of the more important business ratios, they did not reveal the sample size. They went to so much effort to convey some excellent statistics, but left off the one piece of information I sought most. Without a sample size, how could I know if these statistics reflected the experience of 5 or 500 comparable businesses? We can, of course, trust the publisher knows what they're doing, that they would not sell business benchmarks compiled from just 5 businesses. I suppose we have to trust them, right? Should we? I trust the World Health Organization. I trust the British Museum. I do not naturally trust a commercial business. I've watched too many television shows where the evil bad guys are business managers trying to keep a secret. That said, to ask for such trust is just inconsiderate and irresponsible. Noam Chomsky touched on this idea in reference to documentaries. Quote, "Personally, I don't even like to watch documentaries where I agree completely with the thrust of it, because there is something about it that strikes me as sort of false. Namely, it's presenting the facts in a way in which you can only evaluate them from the point of view of the person who put it together. Now, it's also true of the printed page, but less so." Yes, marshal an argument from a few undisputed facts favoring a chosen conclusion. Set aside those facts that weaken our conclusion. Voila! We have a persuasive argument not easily refuted without these absent facts and unmentioned interpretations. The personal and visual nature of documentaries, and I would add especially network news, makes it difficult for the incompletely informed to disbelieve a persuasive argument. We too easily trust distilled images. We have the image, after all. Pictures don't lie unless they're fabricated, right? We seem to overlook video clips can be real but sliced, diced, and biased. Seeing the excited Iraqi crowd toppling a statue of Saddam Hussein speaks to us loudly in a way we cannot easily disbelieve. A year later, I see the documentary WMD, Weapons of Mass Deception, and see how the event was manufactured for the media with a crowd intentionally brought in for the purpose of filming. I am again persuaded, this time, that the event was manufactured. It seems that I cannot hold a degree of disbelief in front of visual material. My eyes do not let me evaluate images as anything other than truth or fabrication. Remember the Rodney King episode in 1991 that led to the riots in Los Angeles, California? Edited footage gave a very vivid appearance of police brutality, an obvious bashing of Rodney King by no fewer than 4 police officers. We quickly offered our trust and outrage at a time when perhaps we should have remained more uncertain. Yes, real images, no, biased and isolated, perhaps unworthy of our trust. Instead, we accused and judged the Los Angeles Police Department solely on the basis of a slice-dice video segment. That may well have been brutality. The Christopher Commission found the Los Angeles Police Department did have trouble with brutality. The law courts concluded that instance was not brutality, though a later civil court case found 2 of the police officers guilty. Then Los Angeles Police Chief Daryl Gates recounts, quote, "No one knew what Rodney King had done beforehand to be stopped. No one realized that he was a parolee and that he was violating his parole. No one knew any of those things. All they saw was this grainy film and police officers hitting him over the head." Close quote. A variety of opinions surfaced, but we saw a video and attained clarity in 10 seconds. Can we not keep a modicum of uncertainty? No, as the police officers were acquitted of all charges but one, citizens rampaged. I believe it probably was police brutality, but in the absence of something stronger than a slice of confronting video footage, perhaps the most sensible response was qualified outrage. I am appalled at the brutality if what I see bears true under closer investigation. The phrase, if what I see bears true, and perhaps also we are simply too far from the event to see clearly, may help us frame our difficulties. We are not without information, but we are starved of the clues we need to believe a conclusion. We are often starved of information. Just who was right in the Kashmiri conflict? The answer should not depend on which side set off the latest bomb. Do we really want to make a 5-second judgment and blame the suggested perpetrator at a time when we have little credible, unbiased information? Have you noticed how some scientific research papers try too hard to present discoveries and conclusions in all possible lights, interpreted according to all possible perspectives? The author-researcher sometimes pretends not even to have an opinion of what the results mean except in a concluding line or two. In good science, there is no persuasion. The scientific paper focuses solely on communicating facts. Academic circles expect such behavior. In political discourse, such raw, unspun facts would be so unusual as to border on unprofessional. How could a professional pundit fail to take an opportunity to spin and bias and persuade us of something? The same can be said of marketing. If 9 out of 10 dentists agree, just what was the question? We shall never know. In some arenas, we expect subterfuge. We expect statements not to have supporting evidence. Spin doctors spin, marketers market. Yet such expectations should not blind us to the fact that this is less than sane, professional, informative writing. In terms of our quality assessment, the author loudly proclaims they are not working with our interests in mind. The author prefers to persuade. While we may not declare this as less than sane, certainly the author and publisher do not deserve our complete trust. They have decided not to earn it. Yes, to a degree, all discussion tries to persuade. What kind of political documentary would engage our minds yet not express a perspective? We may believe in ever-present bias. We may believe in something akin to nepotism and kleptocracy. Perhaps everyone with a public voice has the right, even privilege, to try to bend our views ruthlessly to match theirs. Realistically, so very many authors will try to persuade us, will reach beyond facts and objective conclusions with persuasion. So many authors we encounter will select facts to suit an agenda, hide uncomfortable details, and generally deliver information in an unbalanced, untrustworthy manner. I'm sure I have in this book, though I'm not certain where. Perhaps it is the author's right to persuade us with one-sided arguments, questionable statistics, and undecided alternatives. If we believe this, then we have merely shifted the burden of trust to ourselves. Waive the author's responsibility to deliver trustworthy and balanced information, and we must assume the role of ensuring truth and balance ourselves. We absolutely must gain alternative information and synthesize a decent conclusion to mitigate the effects of persuasion. If we do not assume the mantle, and neither does the author, then perhaps we deserve to be misguided and wrong. Currency. One final issue to consider, date. The internet loves to confound us here, for any date mentioned may mean when the information was prepared, published, compiled, or assembled. As I write this book, I am mindful that some of my guidance dates back to the mid-1990s. The foundation of this information comes from my experience creating the Spire Project between 1997 and 2000. Some elements, like context-based quality assessment, are but a year old, and some ideas come together as I write. The book you hold prints copyright 2007 at the start of the book, but since the book was quickly sent to print, most of this book was typed in mid-2006, mid-2007. Somehow, copyright 2007 fails to express the range of dates involved. I shall release 2 chapters of this book on the internet. As a web page, it may well have a date reflecting when the chapter was published to the internet, and perhaps even the day you downloaded the chapters, depending on how the web page is structured. How very confusing. Statistics suffer the same confusion. Statistics in a 2004 publication by the Australian Bureau of Statistics may refer only to information surveyed a year earlier. Industry statistics are often severely backdated. Perhaps trade to the financial year July 2005 to June 2006 is compiled and published in February 2007. Compiling census material in particular takes time, often a year or more. Articles can also have confusing dates. The publishing process may take days or months. Some magazines reprint articles published elsewhere earlier. An article may be a book excerpt. the material prepared years earlier. Date can easily confuse us. Here are some possible solutions. 1. If the page is prominent, consider consulting the Internet Archive at archives.org for a historical look at the webpage. The Internet Archive will often present prominent webpages as they appear 3 years ago, 2 years ago, and 18 months ago. 2. Sometimes the URL itself indicates a date. xyz.com/news/0601 was probably published in June 2001, the 6th month of 01. Messages sent to newsgroups or mailing lists often have a specific date etched into their complex web address. 3. Your internet browser may be able to detect when a page was last uploaded to the web. With Microsoft's Internet Explorer, under the File pull-down menu, select Properties. Occasionally, this will include a created and modified date. 4. How many links are no longer valid? Links age over time and break. When many links are broken, we should worry about the age of the resource. In my own work, I found about one link in 30 dies in a 3-month period, though this rate is tied to the topic and degree of deep linking, so it's a very crude estimate. 5. For internet and print media alike, look for dated events within the document. Perhaps the author mentioned a news event. I just quoted John Mueller's article in November-December 2005 issue of Foreign Affairs. Shortly, I will mention a case of Elion Gonzalez washing ashore in Florida. Such statements date the writing. 6. Statistics also date a document. If a document refers to statistics published in 2006 but not 2008, then the document was probably prepared between these two dates. 7. Guess. Searching is not the exact science we may prefer it to be. We will guess more as this book proceeds. Perhaps the document presents the internet a little too enthusiastically, a little too rosy, and this alone brings to mind an earlier era. Perhaps the author likes Alta Vista, and while still around, Alta Vista was more famous a few years ago. We have now covered the use of internal clues to judge quality. In Q1, we simply ask, do I find the author sane and professional? Notice this is a different question to the favorite, do I agree with the author? The advantage in asking both questions is that our conclusion is tempered from an implied, I believe and trust you, to a more limited, I find your writing sane and professional. We will not read too much into the appearance and reasonableness of an argument in this way. Is the author clumsy, reserved, and suspicious? Is the author helping us to trust and verify their position? In a sense, do I agree with the author is a completely different issue and quite unrelated to what the author-publisher's behavior suggests. We can easily disagree with an author's perspective and conclusion, but we cannot so easily ignore a perspective delivered in a rational, professional manner. What do we mean by quality? Before we continue on and address source, context, and endorsements, let us review some of the traps and subtle nuances to this issue of quality. I have 3 points I think you will find worthy of a diversion. 1. Internet quality is a fluid concept. 2. Quality is plural. 3. Notions of objective truth may obstruct our search for meaning. The issue of internet quality has changed remarkably over the last few years. In the early days of the internet, all information was suspect. The graphic image of this was a dog sitting before a computer. The caption reads, "On the internet, you never know who you are talking to." Consider nothing on the internet is credible. Everything has to be confirmed with something in print. In time, of course, we improved on abject disbelief. With the early flood of good government information, belated agreement surfaced that some internet information could be trusted. Not everything on the internet held to the standard of dog chatter. Part of this advance rested in identifying government agencies and prominent corporations, since they took great pains to usher in only reputable information to the internet. The presence of .gov in the address was an easy clue, keeping in mind, of course, the often repeated reports of hacked websites. The next improvement, on presumed disbelief, was buried within the information itself. If careful, we can spot questionable material. We can sort the work of high school students from professionals. This, of course, is the use of internal clues to quality. Time progressed and a more serious approach to internet quality emerged, thanks primarily to members of the librarian community. Library science literature includes numerous checklists and mnemonic devices to help judge quality. Two I often see are RAP, reliable, accurate, and plausible, and CARS, credible, accurate, reasonable, and support. A questioning searcher starts a merry chase to determine the character of an item of information. For each, there are several hints and clues. Reliable means reputable, confirmable. Accurate deals with the margin of error, survey size, and precision. If you detect my minor annoyance, this is true. I am thankful for context and endorsements, since they support the reader more firmly, as you will shortly see. Our understanding of quality continues to evolve. It matures with the internet. Perhaps in another 2 years, new ideas on internet quality will emerge. Quality is a fluid concept. I certainly expect the field will continue to develop. For the second trap, I ask you to confront how the notion of good and bad quality distorts more than it reveals. To suggest the word quality is singular is just grossly simplifying a complex situation. When we label information quality as good or bad, we make a value judgment based on who wrote it, when, and why. We also base this on the reputation of the publisher, the credentials of the author, on what others say of the information, on supporting evidence and presentation and style, and so much more. We cobble all this together into a summary, good or bad information. Too simple. Firstly, we really want specifics. We want to get intimate with information. Like a series of stepping stones, quality assessment often takes us to the next task, that of synthesizing a conclusion from several pieces of information. Creative synthesis requires diversity, agreement, and transparency. We will address this shortly, but transparency is the big one. Think about what we do with information. We want to appreciate the many strengths and weaknesses of information, not just apply a label. Secondly, information value depends on our question. Old information may be ideal for identifying the history of a person, but would be useless in locating their current whereabouts. Change our question, and what we value changes too. If we do label information as good or bad, we must relabel with each new question. The label good or bad tells us very little. Good information could be old or new, come from a respected publisher or an anonymous one. It could be from an experienced scientist, a journalist, or a psychotic bystander. Saying good information tells us only that we trust it in isolation. We strip strengths and weaknesses. We reduce bias to a linear measure, to acceptable or not. The good quality label also hints at a mistake in mathematics of quality. Do two good quality items add to a great conclusion, just as two bad items equal one good one? This simply is not so. Two articles from the same old newspaper speak no stronger than one. Two fine articles may reflect the same perspective and refer obliquely to the same supporting evidence. Again, they speak no stronger than one. Yet wildly dissimilar information, when combined, can be much stronger. Suddenly, 1 + 1 = 3. We will not notice this if we strip information of its specific strengths and weaknesses. Time magazine occasionally delivers information in this way. Two articles by different writers describe some newsworthy event from different perspectives. These two apparently separate articles happen to appear in the same magazine edition, side by side. Do these two articles assist us to gather a complete picture? It depends. In a sense, we're discussing just one article artificially split in two for stylistic reasons. Both parts of this split article reflect the publisher's bias. As we read and determine one argument is more persuasive, we cannot interpret this as strongly as we would were the articles truly separate and published in unrelated publications. These two articles share a clear bias. Here is how quality edition really works. Dixie the call girl reports a murder, says Bruno the Cleaver did it, but Dixie is not a reliable quality witness. She could be lying for many reasons. Frankly, a call girl has little credibility in our society. As gumshoe detectives, we hit the road and find a 12-year-old boy who accurately describes the face of the killer. Golly, it sure looks like Bruno the Cleaver. Yet young boys also lack credibility. We consider children far too uncertain to tell the truth. Taken together, Dixie and the young boy's statement offers a strong case for a search warrant. Yet if the young boy were Dixie's son, this is not nearly strong enough. Clearly, details are important. To label both sources as poor quality simply loses the plot. We need details. We need to know who wrote what, not just the name, but credentials, depth of knowledge, and other articles they have prepared, and an indication of their professionalism. We need to know the publisher, their reputation, and other publications they have overseen. What do others say? We need to know this and many other aspects to the information. We need to know the many qualities of information. Remember the old detective shows on TV? The extremely British Inspector Morse listens to classical opera for hours as he ponders the subtle nuances of the information he collects. Inspector Morse does not tally with a scorecard. However, working with the many qualities of information need not be laborious and usually does not require opera music. As we will see with context, many clues positively leap at us in haste. Many clues to quality already flash before our eyes, needing only our recognition to be meaningful. Besides, much of the time we only investigate when quality seems doubtful or suspicious. let us simply see many qualities to information and strive to keep these many qualities distinct in our mind, not lump them together to a simple statement, good or bad. Now for the third trap involving this topic of quality, notions of objective truth may encumber our quest for a meaningful conclusion. Is there truth? Yes and no. To simple questions, there are absolutes. We have John's telephone number, it works, fact. With complex questions, we are often better served avoiding the term fact and truth. Presume ever-present bias instead. Presume facts are unavailable. In a very postmodern perspective, perhaps there are alternative truths. Perhaps truth is simply not a practical possibility. Set aside our search for the most perfect information or pristinely honest information. Instead, let us synthesize something far more valuable from pieces of flawed information. This may seem strange, so let me marshal my argument carefully. Hammurabi, the ancient king of Mesopotamia, lived and ruled in the very early days of civilization in what is modern-day Iraq. Hammurabi was responsible for the very first legal code, including such timeless classics as an eye for an eye. Our question is this: when did Hammurabi live and rule? I reach for the internet and quickly find two conflicting dates. Surely he lived just once. We have made our mistake. The best answer may be a rough date of 1800 BC, give or take 200 years. This conclusion may not suit us. Perhaps we will look closely at the two dates, learn that one comes from a U.S. university professor discussing legal texts. The second comes from the staff of the Louvre Museum in Paris. The Louvre displays Hammurabi's famous stone tablet. The Louvre is reputable. I'm fine with accepting institutional reputation over the date suggested by a lesser-known university scholar. Was my choice driven by a conviction that I had to present just one date for consideration? If we are not careful, our convictions in truth and reality can restrict solutions to our detriment. Hammurabi's life is incompletely known. We already have two dates. Continued searching may lead us to conclude the date of Hammurabi's rule can only be guessed. Truth, however enviable a destination, may well elude us. Another example. Doctors struggle to save a young lady's life. She has cancer, so we hospitalize her. We pump her with chemotherapy. We strive to banish the evils of cancer. Oops, we forgot to ask the young lady if she agrees. We forgot to ask if she wants to spend perhaps her last remaining days of life vomiting into a hospital toilet. Perhaps she feels there is something more important she should be doing. Perhaps her culture, religion, or personal philosophy does not subscribe to our conviction that cancer is evil. Most likely, our patient wants to live and willingly undergoes any treatment for the slightest chance. However, by assuming this, we restrict our conclusions. We close down our options once we stand by certain facts. We distance ourselves from understanding alternative perspectives. Once we label a position as truth, we cannot so easily doubt it. Truth tends to be unquestionable and undeniable in this way. In society, we use various proxies for truth. We refer to expert credentials or institutional reputation. The legal profession seeks not truth, but sufficient proof to convince a jury of our peers, or an educated judge in countries that do not use the jury system. Politicians decide a course of action not based on truth, but on best advice and experience at hand. More cynically, perhaps politicians decide based on what is doable rather than right. Oh, we need our avatars. Let truth inspire us. But truth is often simply not part of our reality. As with our earlier discussion of good and bad information, truth is too simple a concept. Let us revisit fundamentalism for a moment and question whether the truths of a Bible-touting Christian missionary might not restrict their ability to understand a situation with alternative truth. Convinced of the need to protect souls, our young knight Albert will shortly bear witness to a crusade against the Cathars. History will treat the crusade as genocide. If truth has limitations, so does disbelief. We can mistakenly enshrine disbelief. We can move beyond a reluctance to believe in certainty to where we hold all events as always uncertain, always indecisive, no matter how clear the evidence. This, too, is not helpful. Consider the sociology of Holocaust denial. There was a Holocaust, the death of a great many Jewish and other minorities in World War II. Let us not discuss whether it occurred. The evidence is supremely strong. The counter-evidence offered by Holocaust deniers is frankly pathetic in comparison. Yes, history is constantly rewritten and reinterpreted based on a sound argument and evidence. However, we do not rewrite history without evidence. At some point, we draw a line and say we believe this, until strong evidence emerges to suggest otherwise. This is the trap. Start by saying truth is relative. Let's talk about it. Now use this principle to attack any inconvenient but soundly proven argument. Preach, let us discuss whether the Holocaust occurred, but do not then engage in a discussion. Draw strength and awareness from let us discuss, but not from any persuasive argument that should follow. Empowered in this way, Holocaust denial has driven an unargued flight of fancy into the public arena with wide public awareness and wide economic disgust. A most amazing achievement. We get another taste of this effect in a recent U.S. federal court's decision to chastise a Pennsylvania school board for making a curriculum change. This change referred to intelligent design, ID, as an alternative to Darwin's theory of evolution. Judge Jones declared, quote, "To be sure, Darwin's theory of evolution is imperfect. However, the fact that a scientific theory cannot yet render an explanation on every point should not be used as a pretext to thrust an untested alternative hypothesis grounded in religion into the science classroom, or to misrepresent well-established science propositions." Close quote. In comment on this event, Eugenie Scott, executive director of the U.S. National Center for Science Education, states, quote, "It is already clear that the new slogan for the ID movement is going to be teach the controversy, even though there is no scientific controversy over the validity of evolution and biology." Close quote. ID has merit as a religious belief, and we judge religious beliefs by very different criteria. However, ID claims to be science, a science belonging in a classroom where religion is not invited. This is just wrong. Unargued and untestable, ID is not science. Arguing Darwinism is incomplete does not make it science. It resembles Holocaust denial in how both are unargued and unsupported claims standing against well-supported, soundly proven positions. Let's talk about it is used to lift both claims well beyond where they belong. It is not that Darwinism is pure truth, nor that the Holocaust may not one day be reinterpreted in light of new evidence. It is only that you and I should never have heard of Holocaust denial or the science of intelligence design. Why are we entertaining an unargued perspective? When do we discard unargued perspectives? We will not see an end soon to this style of intellectual sleight of hand. Truth and disbelief have their limitations. Sometimes no truth or reputable information can be found. Pretending truth exists in such an ill-informed environment just confuses the situation. Consider popular politics, where we often see only strongly biased information. All is spin. Reality is very confusing half a world away as I watch staged events orchestrated by political action groups reported through the filters of biased news organizations. Whether we're discussing the politics of Chinese-Taiwanese relations or Iraqi redevelopment, we have little more than rumor and spin to work with. Draw conclusions if you will, but do not trust them. Best admit we do not know and work from there. We should have opinions, but recognize when we are poorly informed. I simply cannot know with certainty if Iraq is improving as I write this line in early 2006. Perhaps I should wait a few years for the release of a documentary film, since we all know documentaries never display bias. As you can see, quality is a messy issue. In response, many professional researchers become slightly cynical. We look, decide, but sustain a partial disbelief in everything. We recognize how limited our access may be to the truth, and we know just how easily a reasonable argument can be neither reasonable nor truthful. Now is a good time to return to the tenets of Q4 quality assessment. Information quality emerges from internal clues, source, context, and endorsements. By looking at internal clues, we hope to judge information as sane and professional. Yes, we want information that shouts sanity and professionalism, largely because information with these qualities tends to be, usually, by and by, on most occasions, more valuable. Information that appears sane and professional may not actually be sane or professional, but most often is. Better information also tends to emerge from credible authors and exacting publishers. So now let us turn our attention to the degree of trust we bestow on the author and publisher. Q2, author-publisher identity. An author and publisher with relevant experience reassures us. As our second task, Q2, we look at the identity of the author and publisher. We ask, does this author-publisher combination have the experience to present this kind of information, and if so, with what bias? The internet is a splendid tool to investigate authors and publishers simply because so very much information gets published about authors and publishers. Anyone who creates a single internet document tends to make three or four. Anyone who writes three or four tends to include a short biography. We may seek information on obscure topics by reclusive writers, but usually we just seek information. Since prolific authors say more and have more experience saying it, we usually encounter the prolific authors, authors with biographies. Our first task is simple, find this biography. Q2 overlaps partly with Q3 context, since one of the most useful ways to understand experience and bias is to read additional works by the same author and publisher. Additional publications will probably be found in the same directory as our current article. This will be our first working definition of context. However, for Q2, we will restrict ourselves to what the author and publisher tell us of themselves. We want to read their biography as they present it. To find this biography, 1. Look on the page we are on for a link to personal details. 2. Seek this information nearby. Look especially for a link on the homepage. This may involve hacking the web address or asking a search engine to show us all the pages it has found nearby, two techniques we will explore in Chapter 5. 3. Look beyond the website for this biography. Ask a search engine for an author's name and include a concept or email address unique to the author. 4. Email the author directly. The third tactic bears a closer look. Since many people share the same name, when we search for a name, be sure to include an additional concept associated with that person. This makes for a specific search, as we discussed in Chapter 1. For example, there are many David Novaks on the internet. One prominent David Novak mentioned in the Wikipedia writes about Jewish history. That is not me. I am, however, the only David Novak of significance who writes about internet searching, the Spire Project, or quality assessment. A search for one of these concepts, in quotes, like, quote, David Novak, close quote, quote, internet searching, close quote, would reveal my work. Also, consider using truncation to accommodate instances where the middle name or initial makes for a difference. Many search engines do not allow for truncation. Google offers a truncated version of truncation with the wildcard star key, so that a search for John Star Smith, in quotes, will match John Maynard Smith, the biology professor, and John Hannibal Smith, the 1980s TV star that led the A-Team. Hardcover books include biographical details on the cover slip. Past publications may be listed near the title page. Magazines may include a short biography at the start of the publication, while journals usually introduce authors at the start of an article. The search for author biographies is not unique to the internet. What is unique is the depth of detail we usually encounter. Do not be surprised to uncover pictures of pets and children. The other party to publication is, of course, the publisher. Who are they? Do they have a demonstrated past experience on this topic? Do they have notable commercial affiliations or biased funding sources that may tarnish their objectivity? This is the difference between John said and John, senior prosecutor for the World Court in Geneva, said. The more juicy details may come only from outsiders and emerge only when we look at endorsements, but many traits will still be revealed by the publisher out of self-interest, in the interest of clarity, or because their demonstrated experience forms part of their message. A publisher that is a government agency or an NGO, a non-government organization, or an involved company may want to tell us their background. The publisher of a magazine, a newspaper, or a journal wants us to remember their role in bringing us this information. Our task is simply to consider what they want us to know. Start with the publisher's homepage. If it's difficult to find, hack the web address or ask a search engine for a list of pages within the website. One page or several will describe the publisher's history and affiliations, at least from their perspective of what makes good marketing. There can be plenty of surprises. In an example I often use, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, is a, quote, private international communication service to Eastern and Southeastern Europe, Russia, the Caucasus, Central Asia, the Middle East, and Southwest Asia, close quote. Oh, and it is cheaply funded by the United States Congress. Now, how would the U.S. government affect the reporting of news in Afghanistan? A few pages ago, I included a comment by Eugenie Scott, executive director of the U.S. National Center for Science Education, in relation to intelligent design. How thoughtless of me not to add that the U.S. National Center for Science Education is a private association, not government, as I first assumed. It presents itself as a grassroots association defending the teaching of evolution in public schools. Ah, of course the executive director would state there is no scientific controversy to evolution. Earlier in this chapter, I also mentioned a documentary titled WMD Weapons of Mass Deception. Visit the homepage at wmdthefilm.com, and there on the left, fifth entry in the main menu, is the filmmaker bio. In bold type, it tells us filmmaker Danny Stetter authored 4 books, is the executive editor of an internet project, and an award winner for excellence in documentary journalism. A list of documentaries follow. I am greatly reassured this filmmaker has the experience to produce a fine documentary. As a fine example, let me draw your attention to the Astronomy Pictures of the Day APOD site found at antwerp.gsfs.nasa.gov/apod/astropics.html. We will return to this project several times in this book. APOD features beautiful and intellectually inspiring pictures of planets, stars, and galaxies. Each picture is accompanied by a detailed description of the science, with further links to relevant research papers and official statements of discovery. At the bottom of the page is a link titled About APOD that leads to a list of mirror sites and a brief paragraph that describes how, quote, APOD is originated, written, coordinated, and edited since 1995 by Robert Nemiroff and Jerry Bonnell, close quote. Robert works for Michigan Technology University, while Jerry is a NASA scientist. A search for Robert Nemiroff Michigan Technological University uncovers a short bio that further tells us the two astronomers used to work together at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. Did you notice that APOD is published on the NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center website? The web address starts with antwerpgsfc.nasa.gov. At first, I presumed it was the APOD project by NASA, though their brief biography suggests otherwise. Only by exchanging email with Robert Nemiroff did I learn that NASA's involvement is limited. Quote, NASA controls no formal content nor exerts any explicit editorial control, explains Robert, though he deeply appreciates the NASA website assistant and a recent grant to continue their efforts. Some people seem to think that there is some sort of APOD team, but it is really only Jerry and me, adds Robert. I also learned that Robert and Jerry are two professional astronomers with impeccable credentials. They have created perhaps the Internet's first picture encyclopedia. A NASA project implies editorial and management oversight. It implies a standard of quality and excellence and perhaps an avoidance of risk and other institutional habits. It might imply a preference for NASA images. It certainly implies a resemblance between APOD and other NASA picture archives, like the smaller National Space Science Data Center photo archive, the Great Images in NASA archive, NASA's Johnson Space Center digital image collection, and the Hubble Heritage Image Gallery that includes the cover image for this book. Does it matter? Perhaps it does. For reasons we will address shortly, the APOD project has many excellent qualities. It is, for instance, very famous. However, to judge APOD's quality based on its association with NASA is misinformed. NASA behaves more like their sponsor than publisher. We discover this only by taking the time to gather biographical information. The APOD project also behaves more like a self-published project than a project with an institutional publisher. It routinely sources images from all over the world, including the best amateur photos. As an astronomical picture archive, APOD is unique in this manner. APOD also focuses not on a tool, like Hubble Heritage or GRIN, or on a photo collection, like the JSC or NSSDC, but instead on science, recent science. Remember, the question we ask at this stage of the quality assessment is simply, does this author-publisher combination have the experience to present this kind of information? And if so, where would their bias lie? We will reveal further details when we look at context and endorsements, so we do not need to gather a complete answer at this time. Besides, we do not want to rely solely on information provided by the author and publisher. We do, however, expect the author and publisher's assistance in gathering some background at this stage. Remember, sane and professional writing includes the obligation of telling the reader of any relevant experience and bias. This issue of the identity of the author and publisher, deciding if they have relevant experience to produce good information, should not overly tax our understanding of information. We draw conclusions from author and publisher identity all the time away from the Internet. We expect careful analysis from government reports, very careful analysis from peer-reviewed journals, and oh-so-sloppy consideration from tabloid newspapers. Elvis may live in Jamaica, but we won't know by reading a tabloid. We probably already wonder if reports of some new software could be exaggerated, if a politician is in the pocket of a big business, and if the latest sports star really likes their breakfast cereal, fruity drink, or multicolored sports shoe they promote. This should all be very familiar to us. I demonstrate this by asking you to imagine you are the managing director of a fictional charity called the Smiling Refugee. In 2001, you were given three pieces of information about the starving and neglected refugees of Afghanistan. The first comes from a photojournalist just back from trekking through the war-torn hills of Afghanistan. Her website features a great many forlorn pictures of destitute refugees fleeing civil strife. The second piece of information comes from CARE, an international aid agency with many years' experience working in troubled countries. Their report describes what they are doing to assist Afghan refugees. It estimates refugee numbers and describes the challenges involved in helping them. The third piece of information comes from Bruce Pannier of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, a journalist working on an organization we earlier uncovered is funded by the U.S. Congress. You have probably already selected the source you value most. You already recognize who has the stronger claim to experience, and where the bias for each may rest. I trust you consider the photojournalist perhaps too easily colored by the overwhelming experience of being among destitute refugees. I trust you notice how the photojournalist cannot claim vast experience with refugees, so cannot claim to have perspective. Personally, I suspect all war-torn refugees make for heartrending photographs. I expect you further recognize that while Bruce Pannier is a talented journalist, he too cannot claim considerable experience with other refugee situations, and I have not yet decided where the bias lies for his publisher, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. As we strive to judge and weigh the risks and rewards of Afghan refugee assistance, Bruce Pannier offers excellent coverage of current events, but we really want to listen to CARE and other organizations already assisting refugees in Afghanistan. Connecting author-publisher identity with quality assessment is both simple and obvious. Yet, what if we avoid this whole step of identifying the author-publisher? If we anonymize the information we read, the internet already strips the author and publisher from their words. These details are kept separate from the information we are led to by a search engine. We all too easily read internet information and count it as just another author and publisher we've never encountered before. I am continually surprised how often even experienced internet users fumble like this. How often we overlook source bias. With little interest in who is providing the information, our three documents on Afghan refugees devolve into simply three pieces of information from various sources, suggesting different actions. Do we really want such anonymous information of uncertain bias? Part of being a connoisseur of information is knowing what we consume. Perhaps we really do not care if a pretty image of a pretty galaxy comes from a project published by NASA or only sponsored by NASA. We just like the picture. Yet author-publisher identity is more than a preference. The author-publisher is part of the message. It is like reading a wise man once wrote, quote, "Always think of the universe as one living organism with a single substance and single soul, and observe how all things play their part in the causation of every event that happens," close quote. Nice words, pretty sentiment. This passage was penned by Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius in the 2nd century AD. I find knowing its origin adds something to these words. It adds nuances to the information. It makes me think different thoughts. Here is the difference between simply reading and being internet informed, a difference that reappears each time we reintroduce a new dimension to information like context, endorsements, prominence, format, and publishing model. We have one other reason to invest time learning more about the information we consume, a reason based on what we do with the information after we read it. Creative synthesis. Information synthesis is the key to creating the strongest conclusions. We merge several pieces of information into something new. Take two or more bits of information, compare and contrast them, then generate a conclusion stronger than either fact would justify when considered separately. This process is synthesis. The strongest synthesis emerges when we have three qualities: agreement, diversity, and transparency. We seek agreement from a diverse collection of transparent information. By agreement, I mean a consistent message coming from the evidence. Agreement does not mean absolute, but disagreement muddies the water, so to speak. Disagreement may simply be within the margin of error, or perhaps we can identify a clumsy survey question, or too small a sample size. Perhaps Bruno's girlfriend lies when she says Bruno was with her at the time of the murder. If we catch this lie, then we discard her advice and the information is once again in agreement. We hope for agreement. We hope for corroborating evidence. Diversity also fuels strong synthesis. Marry two items of information with diverse background, and we generate a stronger result. It tells us that two independent assessments draw similar conclusions. In reverse, two statements drawn by the same primary source speak no stronger than one. Transparency refers to our depth of knowledge about the information. We want to know the information we gather: sample size, credentials, bias, funding. When gaps are left in our understanding of information, we weaken synthesized conclusions. Only when we know Dixie and the young boy witness are not related can we with confidence ask for the search warrant. After we gather information, we synthesize a conclusion. Keep this in mind, and perhaps while we gather information, we should look for the best information for this purpose. Seek transparent information. Get intimate with information. Avoid anonymous and unattributed sources. Gather diverse information. Notice bias, then counter it. We must reach beyond pretty pictures and facts to synthesize a strong conclusion. For example, consider the value of wind farms. As a fairly distant observer to this minor conflict, let me recount not the truth of the conflicting opinions, but rather my personal impressions as I investigate. With a quick survey, I decide environmental groups, governments, and the wind industry all firmly endorse wind farms. Wind farms are the solution to our desire for a cleaner world. A second, slightly less audible view hates them intensely. They question their value, suggest they kill birds, and point out that they occasionally shed giant blocks of ice. As I browse the internet, all the prominent internet resources on wind farms are very supportive. Perhaps by approaching a search engine with against, quote, wind farms, close quote, or wind farms, and I find what I consider as fairly irrational arguments, primarily suggesting that wind farms are ugly, noisy, and do little to diminish our reliance on oil and coal. In short, wind farms do not deliver what wind power promises. Lost between these two positions lies a third perspective. I will describe it as not against wind farms, but against how wind farms are being authorized. This position encompasses more than the motto, just not in my backyard. It seems to suggest that while wind power is wonderful, the way wind farms are established supremely irritates neighboring landowners in ways that perhaps country residents fear most. Establishing a giant noisy eyesore that hurts property values resembles someone laying train tracks by our front door. Yet governments support almost all applications and pay subsidies to encourage even more wind farms. I am not well informed about wind farms, which is indeed the purpose for this example, since I must synthesize a conclusion from an incomplete grasp of this topic. However, I have a problem. This third perspective, while critical to understanding the value of wind farms, is drowned out by those ranting and raving against the evils of wind farms, or those blandly declaring the wondrous value of all wind farms. In short, this is a seriously unbalanced discussion. For instance, the British Wind Energy Association, supported by prominence, claims wind farms do not hurt neighboring property values, a statement I find hard to believe. Yet with little research yet complete, those living near proposed and established wind farms have neither proof nor the prominence to counter such a statement. I first noticed this third perspective when I found one of the primary websites supporting wind farms had discrete ties to the wind industry. I began to worry about bias, so I searched for information against wind farms to counter this bias. Then I began to see errors in logic. Someone quotes a report by the German electricity industry, but completely misuses their conclusion. A sensible claim of survey bias stands against one of the few surveys suggesting wind farms don't hurt property values. This confusion leads me to hunt for other angles and for the perspectives of those more informed than I. Greenpeace supports wind power. Government policy seems to authorize all wind farms except under the most serious conditions. Only now do I notice and recognize a few discussion pieces on the sensible issue of property value. A third perspective begins to emerge. Only by considering all three perspectives do I reach my final conclusion, that I am pro-wind power, but troubled by how wind farms are authorized. To form the best conclusions, to synthesize the best information, somehow we must see through this mist of unbalanced discussion tilted towards the loudest voices. Dip lightly into the internet, and we encounter only praise. Search for dissenting voices, and we encounter what I describe as an irrational argument against. Only by listening carefully and noticing the identity of author-publisher do we hear all three perspectives. Whenever we wish for a comprehensive or a definitive answer, we must grapple with this possible situation. We must not let our search tools draw us away from valid but quiet positions. We must not synthesize solutions based on resources supporting just two sides of a three-sided argument. We will revisit unbalanced discussions again in Chapter 9, but synthesis remains a reason always to consider author-publisher experience and bias. There is an abbreviated version to synthesis, and it works like this. Grab a high-quality, reliable format of information. We will introduce format in Chapter 4. Next, simply accept their claim of truthfulness. Stay alert for anything unexpected or suspicious, but essentially trust the author. If something unexpected or disturbing appears, we investigate. This shortened approach works well if we do not need great confidence in our conclusion. If we need such confidence, then better to start with distrust. Interrogate everything to learn of its origins. Say we read an economic research report from a peer-reviewed journal. We can probably trust the author and publisher. Peer-reviewed journals tend to have high quality. The author's peers should notice significant errors before publication. Intent on saving time, we jump directly to the conclusion and read that section carefully. Yet as we read, something strikes us as odd. perhaps the report mentions doing the survey twice or suggests the need for a larger survey size. We investigate. Not knowing the survey size disturbs me, so I will interrogate the information until I'm satisfied with the sample size is sufficient. Of course, in a research report, I have only to read the methodology section. If sample size is not described, I may well choose to disregard the report entirely or contact the author directly for clarification. In this simple approach, we trust information, but only when it conforms to our expectations. We stay vigilant for anything unexpected. This stance works only when we do not expect a significant bias. When we work with less trustworthy resources, with more contentious issues and issues with serious repercussions, do not be so trusting. Q3, context-based quality assessment. We will now address a very simple technique that, once understood, will take all of 5 seconds. This really is simple. There is even a bookmarklet we will describe later that makes this simpler still. It will become a single click and a glance, a mere gesture. Information keeps good company. We know a publisher by what they publish, just as we know a book author by their previous books. In regards to the article on Kashmiri politics mentioned earlier in this chapter, I looked at the table of contents, then quickly paged through the magazine. Nearby articles will reflect the quality of the article I'm interested in. This is context-based quality assessment. Our question for Q3, what company does this article keep? A magazine publisher strives to deliver a particular quality of information. All articles will reach that level or remain unpublished. Thus, a list of articles from the magazine, past or present, will reveal something of the publisher's preference and bias. We know book publishers by the books they publish. The publisher's quality and preferred topics show in their past publications. A newspaper broadcasts its quality and bias through its news articles. London Times, Guardian, and The Sun all differ significantly, and these differences have little to do with geography and distribution. Their differences spring from the quality and selection of their articles, from The Sexy Girl on page 3. Consequently, we know something of the quality of a newspaper by their articles past and present. In all three of these examples, publishers select information to match their standards of quality and bias. Consequently, nothing would be more natural than for us to open a magazine, a publisher's catalog, or a newspaper and skim for an impression of quality, perspective, and bias. After all, their reputation is revealed in what they publish. Yes, we are discussing an aspect of a publisher's reputation seen in the information held nearby. We are discussing context, local context to be precise. Now let us reach for the internet and watch as this fine structure of context collapses into a pile of rubble. Internet information, we are told, has no context. Every page sits beside every other page in this vast cloud of information we call cyberspace. Every item of information has its own qualities and perspectives that exist unrelated to the next page we happen to visit. By such a definition, cyberspace has no neighbors. As we search, we constantly meet new publishers of unknown quality and bias. However, the internet is not a cloud. It is not an ocean. The internet shares all the structure, order, and organization of a galaxy, a finely structured galaxy. Every web page has a specific location as defined by the web address. Publishers place their information together in one place. Now notice how our vision of context quality assessment snaps back into place. Internet information exists in a specific directory. With very few exceptions, all the information within a single directory comes from a single publisher. In most situations, information within a single directory is written by just one author. Context-based quality assessment merely asks that we glance at the other information found within the same directory. Like articles in a magazine, web pages within a directory share context. The URL field searches the key to unlocking local context. With a particular directory in mind, ask our favorite global search engine for a list of all the other web pages that appear in the same directory. Google or Yahoo will happily provide us with such a list when we type inurl:web address. Click the search button and we retrieve a list of perhaps 10 to 300 articles by the same publisher. And if I see one word about reading tea leaves or a fundamentalist slogan, I will have my answer. If a web page that interests me is published right next to a web page about royal jelly lipstick, I will assume, 1, the publisher is the same for both web pages, 2, both articles are held to the same standard of quality, 3, both articles are stupid. Yes, we can dispute each of these assumptions. In a critical way, we should. Firstly, perhaps a new publisher has taken over and is destroying the credibility of a magazine or web project. Quality standards have begun to slip. Secondly, perhaps a brilliant article has found its way to a low-quality location. Sometimes great works of art really are sold at garage sales, and sometimes great authors publish great works in mediocre magazines. Thirdly, perhaps I am wrong about the value of Royal Jelly Lipstick. Perhaps Royal Jelly Lipstick really works and deserves its place on the cover of respected magazines and newspapers everywhere. Context is not a wildly accurate measure of quality. Yet context is central to the way information is sold and consumed on and away from the internet. I would certainly not believe a change in our understanding of gravity when the tabloid newspaper The National Enquirer tells me so. Place the same news in Scientific American or the New York Times, and I am a believer. Context matters. Contextual clues surround information like smells surround our evening dinner. They are ever present. Where there is information, there is context. And just as the smell of dinner reveals what is for dinner, context reveals the quality of information. A reputation is a complex creation arising from past work and the attention and comments it receives. Local context is but one part of reputation. If Q3 asks instead for the reputation, we would have much more difficulty in gathering together the many pieces, the past articles, comments, and fame. It is the simplicity of our question that empowers us. We merely wish to consider the information positioned nearby. So framed, context is often so very revealing. As our example, let us turn our attention to The New Powder Keg in the Middle East, an article by Muhammad Usama bin Laden, published at islam.org.au/articles/15/laden.htm. The name Usama bin Laden positively drips with meaning as I write this line, but let us consider this particular article in context. What else has the same publisher produced? What other articles appear in the same directory? The article appears at islam.org.au/articles/15/laden.htm. So we will ask for articles found in islam.org.au/articles. And we will ask Google by typing in URL : islam.org.au/articles. This last line roughly translates as, show me everything you have found with islam.org.au/articles in its web address. We covered how to do this in Chapter 1. We receive a list that looks like this. Interview with Muhammad Usama bin Laden. The Islamic Taliban movement and the dangers of regional... The Moro Jihad, a continuous struggle for Islamic independence. The Islamic legitimacy of the martyrdom operations... Christian missionaries in the Muslim world manufacturing kufr... The liberation of Constantinople... And so on. If we briefly scan one of these other articles, perhaps the one on Christian missionaries fifth down the list, prepared by a different article, we would read the following paragraph. Quote, perhaps the most insidious method used by Christian missionaries is to kidnap Muslim children from war-torn countries and sell them to non-Muslims to raise as disbelievers. As I read, I begin to make my quality assessment. Oh, please don't make an assumption of all Islamic communities from the actions of one apparently fundamentalist publisher. Such injustice. Also, I'm not propagating a jihad against Islam by mentioning fundamentalism. That said, we should certainly make assumptions about this particular publisher from this publisher's past actions. At our fingertips rests a large selection of past articles with which to judge them. As a second example, say we search for staff retention using Google. The first search engine recommendation draws us to a page titled IDS HR Studies, found at incomesdata.co.uk/studies/impstaffretention.htm. This page introduces a study on staff retention, a study that requires a 3-month trial subscription priced at £50. Is it worth this price? Part of our assessment should include Q3 context, a quick look at information found nearby. This article appears at incomesdata.co.uk/studies/impstaffretention.htm. So we will ask for articles found in incomesdata.co.uk/studies. And we will ask Google by typing in URL :incomesdata.co.uk/studies. Browsing the resulting list of nearby pages, we learn our page about a staff retention study sits beside 106 other IDS studies on other topics important to human resources. I interpret this as serious proof the IDS has worked in this field a long time and has the expertise I seek. Context supports their claim to quality. Context-based quality assessment shines a strong, revealing light on internet information. This simple technique exposes much about a publisher in a quick and concise manner. Furthermore, publishers are ill-equipped to disguise their past actions and associations unless they want to paint their past as a void. This last option is foolish, since publishers can all too easily sink into anonymity. A publisher wishing to disguise a bias may project an image of respectability, accountability, and authority. They may project an image of omniscience. They cannot project an alternative perspective without actually convincing readers of this alternative conclusion or appearing undecided. This means that when a website strives to inform us, a publisher cannot step around their own bias. A newspaper intent on presenting itself as a serious international newspaper better be filled with serious news and not gossip. If we look nearby and see gossip, it is a gossipy tabloid, no matter how much the publisher claims otherwise. Oh, a political party can still pretend to care about an issue, to make policy statements in support of an issue but do little of significance. Context will not reveal this, since their purpose is not to inform us, but rather to gather votes. However, publishers intent on informing us cannot hide easily from their context. And with so few internet users reaching for context, few publishers try. I have seen some incredible statements online in my time, statements that are so obviously biased when observed in context. Wait a moment. Good information keeps good company. Can we really judge an argument by its neighbors? Surely arguments stand on their own. Authors only contribute to their message. Besides, we should read important information irrespective of the author, right? We do not have the time to read everything, so we use context to judge importance. The unproven expert does not really help us appreciate their experience or help us recognize the importance of their work. Without publishing a few articles, essays, a book, or website, the self-published author essentially says, "I know I have not written much of interest before, but this page is different." I find such claims insipid and unconvincing. Almost all great discoveries come gradually from people who work at it and have a track record of working at a topic. If the author has not published anything significant before, do they deserve our attention? Furthermore, the author could not find a publisher willing to recognize the value of this information. I found no publisher willing to vouch for its significance. I could only put it here. Of course I will judge such work harshly. There are two issues to discuss that involve the mechanics of context-based quality assessment. First, we may not want to only look at the immediate directory. In the example just mentioned involving islam.org.au/article/15/laden.htm, we requested a list of all articles in /articles, not just those in /article/15. 15 probably refers to the issue number anyway. We may need to step up another directory to learn something useful. Of course, a URL search for /articles will include anything found in /article/15 as well. Secondly, the URL field search is not the only method to gather context. Two further ways will reveal information positioned nearby, though I hesitate even to mention these alternatives since the URL field search is so simple. In Chapter 5, we will introduce a bookmarklet I add to my web browser that makes using the URL field search as simple as a single click with our mouse. I will also introduce a search tool that automatically converts a pasted web address into a URL field search. The second method involves hacking at the web address and guessing the address to information published nearby. Web addresses are chosen to mean something to the publisher, so with a little practice and a few nearby examples, we can usually guess a page or three. Hacking web addresses can be tricky, but most every directory, for instance, has a home or index page that ends in .htm or .html. We discuss this technique in Chapter 5. A third method involves simply surfing to nearby information. This can be fairly inefficient, but will lead to recently published information, to information perhaps not indexed by a search engine. Context reaches further than we have described here. In Chapter 4, we will investigate the link companion, the electronic footpath, and the information venue. However, as we search for quality, with speed in mind, we want to look only at information positioned immediately beside the page we read. In practice, as I reach Q3, I click a button on my web browser, I browse a list of other documents held nearby, and I decide what they say of the depth, quality, and bias of the information that interests me. At most, I will read a couple documents for flavor. Am I impressed with the volume of information published nearby? On to Q4. As an aside, when we find a lovely article on the internet, we may eagerly wish to read any similar information positioned nearby. Where there is one exciting article, perhaps there are two. The URL field search is once again the key. Simply ask a large search engine for pages they have indexed nearby. Indeed, in this way, the URL field search introduces a second way to traverse a website. We can surf through a website as the publisher intends, or we can pick and choose from the search engine's list of pages instead. For badly constructed websites, this approach works very much to our advantage. Just acknowledge that search engines may not index unpopular pages, not a problem, of course, for websites with prominence. Search engines may also miss the newly published page. I move horizontally through a website in this way, perhaps once every hour I search. I love the flexibility of the URL field search. I also enjoy the role I had in first bringing Google's in-URL field search to public attention, and now in revealing context-based quality assessment. These are two of my grandest discoveries. Knowing my work includes these two significant discoveries should somehow enrich my other words and actions. It becomes part of my reputation, a reputation we can tap into by searching local context. Q4 endorsements. Here is another simple technique that, once understood, takes very little time. This too will become a gesture, a simple and very revealing aside. Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi remains under house arrest for yet another year in Myanmar, Burma, where hundreds of thousands are routinely detained for wanting freedom from tyranny. In 1991, she was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize and has never been anonymous since. Oh, she is not just one struggling opposition speaker among many. As the daughter of a famous general, she was never unknown. But in a sense, the Nobel Prize changed her into a symbol of Burmese democracy, her continued detention proof of its denial. The Nobel Peace Prize is another milestone in her growing popularity, with empowerment arising from this popularity. It is a strong statement of the nobility of her struggle. It is also the only reason I know her name. One of the first pieces of advice I gathered from the National Speakers Association of Australia, NSAA, was that after each speech I deliver, always ask for a testimonial, a statement of support in writing. Post these testimonials to prospective clients, put them on a website, create a book of testimonials, much like the portfolio of a graphic artist or the published articles folder carried by a journalist. Ask for glowing testimonials, even suggest words, guide the process if the client does not object, but let it be their words, their sentiment. Used properly, testimonials allow a speaker to establish credibility without sounding egotistical. I love Japan. I love the land, the culture, the people. With high school memories still fresh in my mind, I toy with the idea of returning to teach English in one of Japan's big English training firms that always seem to advertise for foreigners in English newspapers. Come and teach, they declare. No experience needed. We'll arrange everything. Intent on making an informed choice, I use the internet to investigate the experience of teachers who have taught in Japan already, and run straight into the most extensive hate mail campaign I have ever witnessed. Literally hundreds of past teachers joined together to share their horror stories. Stories like being followed, then reprimanded for befriending locals. Stories like being asked to teach in a way that barely deserves the name. The near-universal message, skip the big three and arrange directly with a smaller English school, one that demands teaching experience and a relevant degree. I read in fascination at the depth of outrage and anger. Awards, testimonials, and hate mail. We are discussing various statements made by people and organizations not involved in what we are investigating, but commenting on it. In one sense, these statements recommend something to our attention. Statements like a Nobel Peace Prize and testimonials speak of significance and support. Hate mail speaks loudly of significance, too. There is anger, certainly, but also significance. This recognition is very valuable on the internet, where attention is so fundamentally important to reaching an audience. In another sense, awards, testimonials, and hate mail all convey a worded message. The noble effort of Aung San Suu Kyi, the proven value of a public speaker, the collective anger of a hate mail campaign raging through a discussion list. Each of these statements speak of much more than importance. I shall use the term endorsements to describe these statements, even though very negative endorsements will occasionally surface. English does not supply that perfect word suggesting appreciation but occasionally meaning slander. Perhaps we can focus on how even negative statements lend a kind of support. Like the Hollywood starlet making scandalous headlines, famous or notorious just as long as people notice. We cannot call such links as mere references, since this term only acknowledges they refer us somewhere. A reference directs our attention. Labeled endorsements, we stress their supportive role in lifting a page from a mere quiet existence towards public attention and significance. We also stress they describe a person, page, or project. They are opinions often by people or organizations much more familiar with our object of interest. Away from the internet, endorsements may imply advertising. Beyoncé endorses Pepsi. Tiger Woods endorses Nike. This happens on the internet, too. Indeed, some endorsements we encounter will be purchased, and we generally wish to ignore these. We can also use the term endorsements in a political sense. Greenpeace endorses a candidate. After investigating the candidate's background, carefully considering their past voting record and future promises, perhaps sharing their concerns in person, Greenpeace as an organization suggests their supporters vote a certain way. This second sense, this political sense, best describes the humble link. After considering the alternatives, a web publisher decides to include this link and not others, asks us to visit this page and not another. We happily listen, thinking their decision rests on a superior understanding of the subject. Drawing once more back to our article on Kashmiri politics, an endorsement is seen when the tea house owner, the librarian, or our friend vouch for a magazine. They purchase this magazine for us to read, not another. They select this article for our attention, not another. They nudge information our direction in a manner that speaks of importance, significance, and appreciation. These are all endorsements. On the internet, the delicate web of vouched-for information, this web of endorsements, persists. Such endorsements may speak very loudly, like the Nobel Peace Prize. Most will speak very quietly indeed. Our task is simply to gather some of these endorsements together, peruse the most interesting, then consider what they say about a resource. Thankfully, gathering endorsements is actually very simple. We already met some of them as links. Endorsements on the internet come in three varieties. 1. Links. 2. Mention of an address, but not as a link. 3. Referring to a project by name. Yes, we are interested in more than just those web pages linking to our page. Indeed, we are interested in several aspects of each endorsement. Who endorses, what they say, and how many endorse. Retrieve a list of endorsements, peruse them, look at the number, the source, and perhaps some of their comments. We now simply add this to our quality assessment. Our question, Q4, what do others say about this information? Such a revealing question. For the first time, we move beyond the direct control of the author and publisher to the words of others. Like testimonials, some endorsements will be carefully cultivated. They may be purchased, seeded, or swapped. At other times, like hate mail from past employees, endorsements may reveal information authors and publishers desperately prefer to keep quiet. We can confirm bias and reveal conflicts of interest thanks to the comments of outsiders. Yes, endorsements speak of more than value and quality. They may also speak of perspective, position, and stance in a marketplace. An absence of endorsements tells us something, too. It suggests a lack of fame and prominence that in turn suggests a new website, a site without promotion, or a site without value. Do be careful interpreting a quiet and unnoticed site as low quality. It may well be brilliant, just unrecognized. However, sometimes quality information may be insignificant because it does not capture the attention needed to influence us. Sometimes the unrecognized website is insignificant indeed. This notion of seeking endorsements is neither new nor foreign to us. We ask these questions already in life. We are, however, uniquely able to retrieve endorsements from the internet so very quickly. With little more than a flick of a wrist, a gesture of interest, we can uncover a list of other people commenting on a website. In comparison, locating dissenting voices to a magazine article takes time and probably money. Sometimes a magazine will publish in their next issue a rebuttal or a counter-argument to a confronting perspective. Sometimes letters to the editor respond with corrections, but we must wait and hope. If not, we must reach for a commercial quality database and start searching for an article that carries an argument further. On the internet, alternative perspectives are built into the system. We merely interrogate the information. We merely ask. Endorsements come in three varieties. 1. Web pages that link. Search for links by using the link field search. Link colon web address. 2. Web pages that mention an address. Search for pages that mention an address. Quote web address. Close quote. 3. Web pages that mention a project by name. Search for a web project by name in a manner specific enough that other projects are not included. This usually means we add choice keywords certain to accompany the project name. To gather endorsements for the Spire project at spireproject.com, we search for link colon spireproject.com. We search for quote spireproject.com, close quote. And we search for Spire Project, Internet Search, or Internet Research, or David Novak. Naturally, we can combine these searches. A bookmarklet in Chapter 5 will assist with this. As a general rule, about as many web pages will include an address as will link to the address. As I write, search engines like Yahoo and All the Web will show more linking sites than Google. Also, different search engines may lead us to different endorsements. Lastly, Yahoo has a link domain field, that allows us to retrieve pages that link to any web page within a domain. Link domain colon Spire Project may reveal links to spireproject.com, spireproject.com/country, and spireproject.com/cn/past. We can almost always find a few endorsements if we wish. Few endorsements will point to or discuss specific pages buried deep within a website, so we may have to chase where the endorsements point. In regards to a contentious report, will someone link to the address of the report, only mention the address, or mention only the organization website? If a meaningless splash page sits on the top of a website, will people point there anyway, or point to a more meaningful second page? Getting a list of endorsements can be finicky in this way. We may need to search several ways to get what we want. Where is this discussion taking us? As I mentioned, the internet is uniquely transparent. We can easily put our ear to the ground and listen to the murmur of conversations discussing a website, business, or author. Furthermore, publishers are little able to and generally unpracticed in hiding the diverse opinions we can dig out in this manner. Because of this, internet endorsements represent a significant reversal of power. I cannot meaningfully accuse and insult a business in the real world, but I can cripple one online. As a case in point, several newspapers trumpeted the near-inevitable lawsuit against the Wikipedia for a transient statement made by a volunteer editor. The Wikipedia is a large encyclopedia where anyone can add entries, but where bad entries are gradually corrected in time by peers and editors. The Wikipedia is a collective project on a collective space. It is also in a legally gray area, since the law does not yet clearly accept the existence of a media commons, public media held in common. Indeed, public land held in common does not have any special legal protection, to my knowledge. The accusation is serious. The threatened lawsuit appears serious. Then I read an article on the Wikipedia that totally disemboweled the individual threatening the lawsuit. A chronicle of past failed internet projects, revealed relationships with deeply biased publications. All the skeletons in the closet are on parade, and I am more inclined to laugh than take the lawsuit seriously. I mention this not to suggest publishers do not have a good recourse against negative endorsements. Indeed, rebuttal can be very effective. I mention this because publishers cannot simply ignore the words of negative endorsements when they lodge in a place where people see them. At least for a transient time, accusations of misconduct travel well on the internet. Perhaps in time, as more and more surface, they will become as routine and ignorable as spam. However, they do travel now. Furthermore, as internet users learn to reach more frequently for endorsements, the visibility of negative endorsements will grow. Most endorsements are neither negative nor particularly positive. They reference and suggest significance or represent support, perhaps just financial support. Indeed, this is one task we must set ourselves as we view endorsements. Why are these endorsements made? We are interested in trends, so thankfully our answer is usually very clear. We retrieve basic information from the web address of each endorsement, so reading endorsements will take little time. We will cover how in Chapter 7. A link from some professor's university course notes means significance to university students. A link from a newspaper means it was in the news. A link from a personal page may mean many things, but a quick look at where the link sits on a page should be enough to decide. Collectively, a link on 30 directories definitely means significance, and we can return to our Chapter 2 discussion on prominence to explore this further. Here is the first of two examples. Astronomy Pictures of the Day, APOD, at antwerpgsfc.nasa.gov/APOD. Google tells us it has 600,000 references for APOD Pictures of the Day. Link, colon, the address, on Google reveals 3,700 links and 56,000 links on all the web. These links come from a diverse range of pages, some personal, some university department websites, many from international websites. I also see a collection of mirror sites and a Yahoo listing without looking deeply. With numbers as large as these, our quality assessment is overwhelmed with presumed significance and longevity. I am not seeing evidence of peer respect, but I did not look in a way that would reveal it clearly. Certainly the university links and NASA involvement suggest peer respect. It appears APOD finds its way to many a page of assorted links and many a page pointing to astronomical pictures. This is all partly a result of being on the internet since 1995. However, an all-the-web search for linkantwerp.nasa.gov/APOD, url:gov or url:edu, reveals 2,990 links from government and educational sources. Many of these links would have been hard to earn without peer respect. As a small aside, I could not get Google's help with this last search, so I quickly jumped to All the Web, a search engine that has less difficulty with complex mixed field searches. Washington Institute of Far East Studies at washingtoninstitute.org. I first encountered the Washington Institute several years ago through the work of Noam Chomsky in his book, The Prosperous Few and the Restless Many. In this 1993 book, he wrote, quote, Martin Indyk, who President Clinton appointed to the Middle East desk of the U.S. National Security Council, headed a fraudulent research institute, the Washington Institute for Near East Studies. It's mainly so that journalists who want to publish Israeli propaganda, but want to do it objectively, can quote somebody who'll express what they once said. For those readers not familiar with his writing, this is vintage Noam Chomsky. He likes to throw out a confronting statement, the plain truth, then discuss it further. I think of him as the academic forerunner of Michael Moore. The internet offers us a great opportunity to confirm or dispel his accusation against the Washington Institute. In early 2005, I searched Google for link:washingtoninstitute.org or, quote, the Washington Institute for Near East, close quote, or, quote, washingtoninstitute.org, close quote. This returns more than 50,000 matches. All of these endorsements link, mention, or refer to the organization. Obviously, this is a significant institute. People talk about it. Buried somewhere in this 50,000 endorsements may be some confirmation that they are, as Noam Chomsky claims, a fraudulent research institute. The first few references make statements like the following. Founded in 1985, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy is a public educational foundation dedicated to the scholarly research and informed debate of U.S. interests in the Middle East. This does not sound like a fraudulent institute to me. I will not find confirmation easily by just browsing such endorsements. So I search. I add neocon or neoconservative to my earlier search, a reason that if someone considers the institute as fraudulent, it is probably in relation to the neoconservative movement, a U.S. interventionist or hawkish political movement. My list of 50,000 statements shrinks to just 938. I could search with different terms. In the wind farm example, I simply used wind farm against. I just need to find the right term. With neoconservative added, the 938 remaining endorsements discuss the Washington Institute in less glowing terms, some of them very similar to Noam Chomsky's statement above. Now for the critical step. Some of these statements are from significant and trustworthy sources, from academics, international newspapers, and the activist scene. Some are definitely not trusted sources. In this circumstance, I suspect statements found on aljazeera.info need not be considered with great care. I appreciate the work of Joel Benin, professor of history at Stanford University, in his article, U.S. The Pro-Sharon Think Tank, as it appeared in Le Monde Diplomatique. Quote, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy influences the thinking of the U.S. government and has a near monopoly on the supply of expert witnesses to the media, close quote. Keep in mind, the number of endorsements that mention neocon or neoconservative does not signify anything. That was only a means to reach a significant voice making similar arguments to that of Noam Chomsky. Yes, they exist. We have not proven the Washington Institute is a fraudulent institute, but we are exploring this perspective, and it looks less unlikely. Endorsements move us beyond the control of the author and publisher to the comments of interested bystanders, peers, and involved institutions. We learn of prominence, significance, and bias. Endorsements also reveal related and comparable information through link companions, a topic for Chapter 4. We will see endorsements and local context solve many further challenges as this book proceeds. Time to bring this together. Here is a complete Q4 quality assessment from start to finish. Practice in quality assessment. There was an online book titled Information Research on Internet, Techniques, Strategy, and Resources, once located at in.geocities.com/samdarshipali/library. Q1. Yes, delivered in a sane and professional manner. The writing is good, sane. It includes a link to biographical details and also a bibliography. Furthermore, the conclusions are well argued and succinct, the language precise. The copyright date indicates 2002, and other indications suggest the information is a few years old, but otherwise nothing of concern. Q2. Yes, the author has the experience and expertise to present this information. It is self-published. The information is found on the Indian GeoCities web farm. Perhaps a concern, but the author graduated from Library and Information Science and holds an MA in Economics, with some computing experience. The full resume is actually very impressive and reassuring, quite appropriate as an author of a book on internet research. Q3. Okay, this information keeps good company, but nothing to shine any further light on his search experience. Context does not reveal much on this occasion. Beyond this lengthy book, Samdarshipali also placed some information about MySQL and web databases. MySQL is a fairly technical topic, a good sign, though the website contains nothing else on internet research. Q4. We reach endorsements. Early in 2004, a search for link://in.geostudies.com/semdarshipali/library revealed a listing in the prominent DMOS directory. This was a significant and prominent link. Beneath the link, we could have found a reference to an article I wrote about how this online book was plagiarized. Yes, Semdarshipali extensively plagiarized my work on the Spire project. Proof sits at spireproject.com/art16.htm. Plagiarism is sad and a little irritating. I'm actually flattered somebody would hold my work so dear as to steal it, then spend hours improving it. This episode was more of a challenge because information research on the internet gained prominence. This prominence lent Semdarshipali the appearance of integrity and by extension tossed my integrity in doubt. Does it matter? This is not so subtle an influence. When I hold an author in disrespect, I do not believe their conclusions and generally discard their opinions. As this book proceeds, I hope to convince you identity matters, that it forms part of our conversation. We will see further examples where endorsements supply some critical piece of information as this book proceeds. Please note how nothing in our initial quality assessment suggested plagiarism until we looked at endorsements. This is the only dimension of quality assessment truly beyond the control of the author and publisher. Until I published a counter-article, the document had convincing quality. Generally, too, much of the appearance of quality comes solely from the trust we have in the author and publisher, as well as various internal clues. Too much of our quality assessment can be manipulated because of this. Conclusion. I intended this chapter to sketch for you a clear and concise way to tap into the quality dimension of the Internet. Q4 quality assessment is my current advice. Q4 proves so helpful because it draws us to ask four distinct questions very suited to the Internet. Q1, is the information delivered in a sane, professional manner? So internal clues. Q2, does the author and publisher have the experience to deliver this information? If so, with what bias? So author-publisher identity. Q3, does this information keep good company? So local context. Q4, what do others say about this information? So endorsements. We could easily ask other questions. We could ask more questions. I like these questions because they reveal most about what I want to know about information quality and reveal it quickly, easily. I am personally never far from my context bookmarklet, never hesitant to ask for an author's identity, and always ready to reach for the opinions of others. It is simply something I do when I wander the internet. As a connoisseur of information, I want to know what I consume. There are other approaches to quality to consider. Internet literature on this topic seems to pool on the Open Directory Project's listing for website evaluation. Of course, I like Q4 most, but it helps to be flexible. For instance, we may require more or less certainty depending on what we do with the information. A hunch is enough to place a bet on a horse. Much more is required to declare war on a small country. How much time and effort do we have for quality assessment? If quality means very little to us, we may simply judge quality on format alone, a topic for Chapter 4. Alternatively, if we need something stronger, we delve deeper. We may confirm elements in the author's claimed identity, retrieve previous published material by those involved, and discern a history or origin of ideas present. If we wish to assassinate someone's character, we will need more ammunition than Q4 provides. In an extreme case, particularly for scientific research, we may replicate the original work. Let us align our telescopes and calculate for ourselves if the asteroid really will hit New York City. Q4 quality assessment is only a tool, though a most versatile and revealing tool. I would mention one last issue on quality, that of the state of information in our world today. We will encounter a vast range of quality on the internet, as well as a vast range of bias. Do not underestimate how much the appearance of truth can be twisted without our awareness. Years ago, I spoke to a man who described how the national GDP figures for Singapore were artificially inflated after their land value bubble burst. Certainly, we know the budget deficit figures for Pakistan were completely rewritten after the 1999 coup from 2% to 7.5%. I'm not suggesting the Singaporean accusation is true, rather that such national statistics, widely considered as truth incarnate, are not intrinsically trustworthy. Another acquaintance previously worked in the management team of an international dental supply company. He described how he routinely approached the loudest of researchers speaking out against his company's products. He would offer them considerable sums of money to do research into the effectiveness of his products. Well over 100,000 at times would go to support research by scientists publishing reports critical of the company's products. Such substantial sums usually silenced the negative publicity. Do not underestimate the influence brought to bear upon information. At the other extreme, I am continually surprised by the depth of understanding that a simple expert has of situations that appear complex from a distance. A whole class of experts, driven to understand their field through years of effort and experience, go on to publish vast, extensive websites or tell-all books that describe in great detail information only visible to insiders. Often such individual experts can be identified from the depth of their thinking and the extensive nature of their websites. I am also continually surprised by talented government staff. I jokingly refer to this class of workers as a collection of highly motivated, talented, and impassioned individuals tightly bound up in red tape. They may be unable to publish directly, often for political reasons, yet approach in person or through a personal email, and many become fountains of highly prized information. They are, after all, deeply experienced and paid to understand a critical situation, even if they find themselves powerless to improve it. Let me offer this simple warning. However skilled our assessment of quality and bias, sometimes we will be wrong. When we investigate quality, we will be wrong less often.